And political activist who practiced civil rights and civil liberties law for over 50 years. He's past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. He's also a co-founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace and a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He hosts the podcast Speaking Freely and is, of course, a co-host here on Law and Disorder. Of course, Mr. Rohde is speaking only for himself today. Stephen Rohde, welcome to the guest seat on Law and Disorder.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with both of you today.
Well, last week, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to allow the Trump administration to gut the Department of Education, a decision that Ian Millhiser of Vox Magazine called the biggest victory of Trump's second term. The decision was one of many controversial decisions that was heard on the court's so-called shadow docket. Tell us about the case and the shadow docket.
Thank you. Yes, we're going to be talking about this shadow docket. I'm beginning to call it the shameful docket. I think listeners presume that when a Supreme Court decision comes out, it's gone through the process. There's been briefing. There have been the availability of amicus briefs. There has been an oral argument. The judges have conferenced and come up with a decision, issue that decision with reasoning and analysis and legal authorities. And sometimes there are dissents that disagree with the majority opinion. Well, this season in the Supreme Court, they have elevated what are called emergency applications for a stay. It is having...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It's been more than 15 days that I've come out and found nothing. Even when aid was available, I got nothing. I'm not eating. If I don't go out like this to get food aid, even if it means dying, I won't survive.
Starvation in Gaza. Facing growing international pressure, Israel allows a trickle of aid into Gaza, but the UN calls it a drop in the ocean. We'll go to central Gaza for an update. Then, for the second time in less than 2 months, Israeli forces raid a civilian aid ship in international waters bound for Gaza with baby formula, diapers, food, and medicine on board.
We demand that you stand down, that you not attack the civilian vessel that is carrying only humanitarian aid. Why are you afraid of baby formula and teddy bears that are destined for the children of Gaza?
That's Palestinian human rights attorney Huwaida Araf, flotilla organizer. We'll speak with her after she's just been released from detention. And finally, in an attempt to quell the MAGA-based uproar over the Trump administration's refusal to release the files of dead serial sex abuser Jeffrey Epstein, Trump's deputy attorney general, who was Trump's former private lawyer, just finished 2 days of meetings with convicted felon Ghislaine Maxwell, serving a 20-year sentence for conspiring with Epstein to sexually abuse young girls. What are Trump's plans for her?
Would you consider a pardon or a commutation for Ghislaine Maxwell if
cooperated? It's something I haven't thought about. It's really something
recommended.
It's something I'm allowed to do, but it's something I have not thought about.
We'll speak with Vicki Ward, longtime investigative journalist and host of the series Chasing Ghislaine, the untold story of the woman in Epstein's shadow. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Health officials in Gaza say at least 14 Palestinians have starved to death over the past day, bringing the total to at least 147, including 88 children. Facing growing international pressure, Israel's allowed some additional aid into Gaza, including by airdrops, but the UN says it's still just a drop in the ocean of what's needed. Israel also said it'll pause attacks for periods of the day in parts of Gaza, but the death toll keeps climbing. Earlier today, Israeli forces opened fire at two food sites. On Sunday, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinians and injured 54 who gathered along an aid convoy route in central Gaza. Earlier today, two leading Israeli human rights groups, B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights, issued reports accusing Israel of committing genocide in Gaza. Yuli Novak, the director of B'Tselem, said, quote, "What we see is a clear, intentional attack on civilians in order to destroy a group. I think every human being has to ask himself, what do you do in the face of genocide?" Unquote. On Sunday, Hamas chief Khalil al-Haya accused Israel of sabotaging ceasefire negotiations.
"There is no point on continuing negotiations under blockade, extermination, and starvation of our children, women, and people in the Gaza Strip. The immediate dignified entry of food and medications to our people is the real and serious expression of the viability of continuing negotiations."
This comes as officials in Gaza say more than 40,000 infants under 1 year old are at risk of a slow death due to a catastrophic shortage of baby formula. On Friday, scores of Palestinians scrambled for food at a makeshift soup kitchen in Gaza City.
"I have a 2.5-year-old daughter. When she saw the empty pot, she started to slap her face. There's no food, no water. I gave her a sip of water to make her stop. Then our neighbor gave her half a loaf of bread. He told her, 'Take this, eat. We are living with no food or drink, no food, no bread, not even water. We're craving even the water.'"
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denies there's starvation in Gaza.
"Israel is presented as though we are applying a campaign of starvation in Gaza. What a bold-faced lie. There is no policy of starvation in Gaza, and there is no starvation in Gaza."
For the second time in less than 2 months, Israeli forces have raided a civilian aid ship bound for Gaza in international waters. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition was attempting to break the Israeli siege by sailing the Handala ship to Gaza with baby formula, diapers, food, and medicine on board. On Saturday night, Israeli forces seized the aid and detained the ship's crew of 21 civilians, including parliamentarians, human rights lawyers, and journalists. Just before the raid, one of the flotilla organizers, Huwaida Araf, spoke by phone with the Israeli forces from the ship.
"This vessel carries food and baby formula for children that your government is deliberately starving. Your blockade is deliberately starving children to death. You have no authority to enforce an illegal blockade. This is a war crime."
We'll speak with the Palestinian-American human rights lawyer Huwaida Araf later in the broadcast. The Pentagon says it killed a senior Islamic State leader and two other members of ISIS in Aleppo, Syria, in a raid Friday. The Pentagon says the men posed a threat to U.S. forces and the new Syrian government. This comes weeks after the U.S. lifted most economic sanctions on Syria. On Sunday, the head of Syria's Electoral Commission announced the country is set to hold its first parliamentary election under the new government in September. The United States and European Union have announced a deal to avert a transatlantic trade war. Under the deal, the U.S. would impose a 15% tariff on most European imports, a large increase over the current rate, but far smaller than what Trump had threatened. The EU also agreed to purchase more than $750 billion of energy products from the U.S. and invest an additional $600 billion in the U.S. Trump's announced deal in Scotland, where he met with the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
"We have a deal. We have a trade deal between the two largest economies in the world.
And it's a big deal. It's a huge deal. It will bring stability. It will bring predictability. That's very important for our businesses on both sides of the Atlantic. It's 15% tariffs across the board, all inclusive.
President Trump is meeting with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer today in Scotland. On Saturday, anti-Trump protests were held in the Scottish cities of Edinburgh and Aberdeen, while Trump played golf at his luxury resort, Trump Turnberry. In Edinburgh, protesters called on European leaders to stand up against Trump.
We want them to stand up for the people in Palestine. We want them to stand up for the people in Ukraine. We want them to stand up against Trump's bullying of tariffs all around the world.
A federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit by the Trump administration against the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois over its sanctuary policies that limit cooperation with federal immigration agencies. U.S. District Judge Lindsey Jenkins said the sanctuary policies are protected by the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker praised the ruling, saying it'll ensure state law enforcement is, quote, not carrying out the Trump administration's unlawful policies or trouble tactics, unquote. In an attempt to quell the MAGA base uproar over the Trump administration's refusal to release the files of the dead serial sex abuser Jeffrey Epstein, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, President Trump's former private lawyer, held a second day of meetings on Friday with Ghislaine Maxwell, who's serving a 20-year sentence for conspiring with Jeffrey Epstein. Blanche met with Maxwell for 9 hours at the federal courthouse in Tallahassee, Florida. On Friday, Trump was questioned if he's considered pardoning Maxwell.
Would you consider a pardon or a commutation for Ghislaine Maxwell? If
it's something I haven't thought about. It's really
recommended.
It's something I'm allowed to do, but it's something I have not thought about.
We'll speak with investigative journalist Vicky Ward about Ghislaine Maxwell and the serial sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein later in the broadcast. In international news, Malaysia's president says Thailand and Cambodia have agreed to a, quote, immediate and unconditional ceasefire set to begin at midnight. 33 people have been killed, thousands displaced since fighting erupted last week. The conflict between the two countries dates back to over a century ago during France's occupation of the region. Doctors Without Borders says 652 children have died of malnutrition in the Nigerian state of Katsina during the first half of this year. The charity said the deaths were due to funding cuts from international donors, particularly from the United States, the United Kingdom, and the European Union. In eastern Congo, Islamic State-backed rebels killed 38 people and injured 15 at a Catholic church on Sunday. Officials told Reuters the rebels wielded guns and machetes and attacked worshippers who were taking part in night mass. Several others are still missing. Ukraine and Russia continued to trade drone attacks. On Saturday, Ukraine said 200 Russian drones and 30 missiles targeted Dnipro, killing 3 people. In Russia, 2 people died in a Ukrainian drone strike. Meanwhile, Reuters has revealed new details about the role Elon Musk has personally played in the war in Ukraine. In 2022, when Ukraine pushed to regain some of its territory back from Russia, Reuters reports Musk ordered the shutdown of Ukraine's access to his Starlink satellite service. The Ukrainian offensive stalled as its drones monitoring Russian forces went dark. A source told Reuters the decision allowed Musk to take, quote, the outcome of a war into his own hands, unquote. The New York Times reveals the Trump administration's trying to keep secret how much it'll cost to renovate the $400 million jumbo luxury jet recently gifted to the Trump administration from the royal family of Qatar. The Times noted $934 million has been mysteriously transferred from a project to modernize the U.S. nuclear arsenal. While federal funds will pay for the renovations, the plane will be transferred to Trump and his presidential library after he leaves office. The congressional-funded U.S. Institute of Peace has a new head, State Department official Darren Beatty. During Trump's first term, Beatty served as a White House speechwriter, but was fired for speaking at a gathering of prominent white nationalists. Last year, he posted a message on X, writing, quote, competent white men must be in charge if you want things to work, unquote. After coming under bipartisan pressure, the Trump administration's agreed to release more than $5 billion in frozen education funding for public schools. The money had been previously approved by Congress for English language programs, student enrichment, and adult literacy and other programs. Here in New York on Saturday, disability activists took over the lobby of Trump Tower to protest against the Trump administration's cuts to Medicaid. The New York Daily News reports 11 people were arrested at Trump Tower. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of people protested in 225 towns and cities as part of the family's first national day of action. It comes weeks after President Trump signed a bill that could result in 17 million Americans losing their health insurance. The protests were timed to coincide with the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act and the 60th anniversary of Medicaid, which is this Wednesday. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza, where health officials say at least 14 Palestinians have starved to death over the past day, bringing the total to at least 147, including 88 children. Facing growing international pressure, Israel's allowed some additional aid into Gaza, including by airdrops, but the UN said it's still just a, quote, drop in the ocean of what's needed. Israel also said it would pause attacks for periods of the day in parts of Gaza, but the death toll keeps climbing. Earlier today, Israeli forces opened fire at two food sites. On Sunday, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinians and injured 54 who had gathered along an aid convoy route in central Gaza. Earlier today, 2 leading Israeli human rights groups, B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights, issued reports accusing Israel of committing genocide in Gaza. Yuli Novak, the director of B'Tselem, said, quote, what we see is a clear, intentional attack on civilians in order to destroy a group. I think every human being has to ask himself, what do you do in the face of genocide, unquote. On Sunday, Hamas chief Khalil al-Haya accused Israel of sabotaging ceasefire negotiations.
There is no point in continuing negotiations under blockade, extermination, and starvation of our children, women, and people in the Gaza Strip. The immediate dignified entry of food and medications to our people is the real and serious expression of the viability of continuing negotiations.
This comes as officials in Gaza say more than 40,000 infants under 1 year old are at risk of a slow death due to a catastrophic shortage of baby formula. This is a Palestinian mother of 6.
This child, who is 4 years old, should weigh 10 kilograms, but he currently weighs 7 kilos and 400 grams, the highest level of malnourishment. This other child, Youssef, before the war, he weighed 13 kilos. His weight was excellent despite his illness. 13 kilos for him was great. Now he is 9 kilos. He is a skeleton. He is more malnourished than his brother.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denies that there is starvation in Gaza.
Israel is presented as though we are applying a campaign of starvation in Gaza. What a bold-faced lie. There is no policy of starvation in Gaza, and there is no starvation in Gaza.
For more, we go to Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, where we're joined by Iyad Amawi, a representative of the Gaza Relief Committee, a coordinator for local NGOs. You have said the famine is worse than bombardment. Can you describe, Iyad, what's happening on the ground right now?
Thank you for hosting me. Yes, The rapid deterioration in the malnutrition, we now suffering from the acute malnutrition for our children, especially and elderly people. Look, the our indicators is very bad and rapidly decreasing the hope for saving children's life. In June 2025, our statistics indicates that for more than 15% of our children under 5 years old is suffering from acute malnutrition. So this is a rapid deterioration, and we cannot, it's unbearable for us to save their lives, as the mothers before a while mentioned. The baby formula also the main struggle issue here in Gaza for most of our babies under the 2 years old. So in my thoughts, when I mentioned it's more aggressive than the bombardment, because it's caused the death rapidly for especially children and elderly people who are suffering from chronic disease and need special nutrition. You can imagine our families here just survive over one meal maybe at the day. And most of our adults reduces their portion of the food to feed their children. So the famine is also aggressing more than the bombardments and will cause a huge amount of children rapidly lose their life. So the main categories now to save the children, in our statistics, we recorded that more than 5,000 babies were suffering from acute malnutrition. This is percentage is more than 150% from the previous March.
So Israel says it's implementing humanitarian pauses, pauses of bombing in densely populated areas. Yet we have reports on Sunday Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinians, injured 54 who had gathered along an aid convoy route in central Gaza. That's something that has been happening regularly over the past months. Can you explain what's happening on the ground?
Of course. Look, the GHF warehouses, I mentioned before, it's a death trap. Yesterday, the Israeli occupation announced the truce for the humanitarian corridor and some operations for aid distributions. The people there still waiting, crowded thousands and thousands in the cross area and at the GHF warehouses and everywhere in the eastern part of the Gaza Strip. It's cited in the red zone that the Israeli mentioned this is a truce. When they achieve that region, they randomly shooting people in the Netzarim corridor also, where the people is still waiting there, and cause more than 14 martyrs and more than 50 casualties, most of them seriously injured. So over the ground, nothing tangibly changed from before, after the Israeli announced the ceasefire temporary for aid and distribution of aid. And also, the amount of food they let come into the Gaza, it's completely will not change the catastrophe here, because it's very less, more than our daily needs here.
As we're broadcasting, we've just heard that President Trump, who was asked by journalists at a news conference in Scotland if he agrees with the Israeli government's assessment that there's no starvation in Gaza. Trump replied, not particularly. He said he's seen them on TV and those children look very hungry. The U.S. president added that the U.S. is giving a lot of money to support the aid effort in Gaza. He recently was interviewed and said the U.S. had given $60 million in aid. Where was the thank you, he asked. Ehud Hamawi, if you can talk about what's getting out there and your response to President Trump.
Look, Mr. President Trump promises Gazans multiple times, more than 20 times, he needs a peace for Gaza and he will bring a peace. But in our thoughts as a locals and as NGOs coordinator, Trump's mentioned that multiple times, but nothing tangible happened after each statement from the President Trump. So in our thoughts, it's just statements. But if they need a critical and to stop this genocide, we believe they can do urgently direct interventions and stop the genocide and pose the catastrophe and force the Israeli to let the aids come in freely without Israeli restrictions. And if Mr. Trump needs to know if is there a real famine here, please let the international journalists come to the Gaza freely and remove the ban over the journalists from the international community. And those people can reflect also the reality. As NGOs coordinators, I mentioned multiple times, we have no time to wait a new political statements. We're sending more than one human appeal to save our children's life. Gaza completely destroyed. Nothing here exists to stand in this circumstances. Mr. Trump must recognize that from the day, maybe we have no any amount of sweet waters because the full ban for the fuel to come into the Gaza freely caused suspension for the water desalination station here. So until this moment, nothing could change, just the statements in the media. So we hope something will change directly, and we sending another human appeal for the international community to do interventions urgently and to open a real humanitarian corridor, not the airdrops. It's not cause any tangible things here.
And so what has been the policy change exactly? I mean, you have the GHF, they shut down all the other aid sites. The UN had an extensive aid sites of, what, hundreds where they distributed. That was shut down. Now they're allowing in what the UN calls a drop in the ocean. What would it require for you, for people to be fed there? And can you talk about what you think the hopes are of a ceasefire, actually a permanent ceasefire?
That's a great question. Look, at the main point after the truce is mentioned from the Israeli side, we need a complete commitment from the Israeli occupation. After that, they let the numbers more than 500 trucks day by day for more than 2 weeks to entering the Gaza freely. After that, we can break the famine and stop this horrible scenes that others can see. And also, if they need to complete stop this starvation, they can. Look, the GHF warehouses is established at the south part of the Gaza Strip. They pushed most of us in the shrinked area, to the coastal area, just 30 square kilometers, and they need to feed us in this shrinked area, and there is no shelters, there is no guaranteed shelters also, and there is no available amount of trucks that can feed us freely without maybe facing threats day by day. You cannot imagine when the people is crowded over the trucks and agree, maybe have a lot of aggression between the civilians here. The GHF causes something like fabric collapsation in the society because they force people to walk more than 15 kilometers to obtain some or seek some foods. It's unbearable for the women and children and elderly people and who have a disability to move to day by day to go to the GHF warehouse at Rafah. I know a lot of my people went there from the north and from the Gaza town. They walked more than 15 kilometers. That's horrible scenes. They cause for those civilians suffering more and more. This is a collective punishment, really.
Iyad Amawi, I want to thank you very much for being with us, representative of the Gaza Relief Committee, coordinator for local NGOs, speaking to us from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. When we come back, for the second time in less than 2 months, Israeli forces have raided a civilian aid ship in international waters that were bound for Gaza with baby formula, diapers, food, and medicine on board. We'll speak with the flotilla organizer, Palestinian-American human rights attorney Huwaida Araf, just released from detention. Stay with us.
If you want to make the weather, then you have to take the blame. If sometimes dark clouds fill the sky and it starts to rain, and folks complain, and though your head may tell you to run and hide, listen to your heart and you'll find me right by your side, because I keep faith.
I keep faith by Billy Bragg in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the second time in less than 2 months, Israeli forces have raided a civilian aid ship bound for Gaza in international waters. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition was attempting to break the Israeli siege by sailing the Handala ship to Gaza with baby formula, diapers, food, and medicine on board. On Saturday night, Israeli forces seized the aid and detained the ship's crew of 21 civilians, including parliamentarians, human rights lawyers, and journalists. Just before the raid, one of the flotilla organizers, Huwaida Araf, spoke by phone with the Israeli forces.
And we are sailing lawfully in international waters where you have no jurisdiction, have no lawful jurisdiction. We're starving civilians. Any blockade that starves civilians or has a disproportionate harmful effect on a civilian population is illegal. And therefore, you have no authority to enforce an illegal blockade. And as such, you are not permitted to use any kind of force to enforce an illegal blockade. We demand that you stand down, that you not attack the civilian vessel that is carrying only humanitarian aid. Why are you afraid of baby formula and teddy bears that are destined for the children of Gaza? You spew your propaganda about Hamas. This vessel carries food and baby formula for children that your government is deliberately starving. Your blockade is deliberately starving children to death. You have no authority to enforce an illegal blockade. This is a war crime. You are responsible for the health, well-being, and safety of all civilians aboard this vessel, and any attack on us is a violation of international law, for which you will be held accountable by the international community.
That was Palestinian-American human rights attorney Huwaida Araf just before Israeli forces detained the Freedom Flotilla's crew of 21 civilians. She's just been released and joins us now from Yaffa. We spoke to you on Friday when you were still sailing in international waters. Huwaida, can you take us through what happened on Saturday night?
Yes, thank you for having me, Amy. So on Saturday, we were getting reports from the Israeli media that Israel plans to give us the opportunity to turn around, which of course we wouldn't do because we intend to challenge and break this illegal blockade. And if we did not turn around, then it would forcefully seize our vessel. The thing is, they had not made any contact with us whatsoever. So at a certain point when we saw on our radar strange activity by a number of ships, which we suspected to be the Israeli Navy, I tried to initiate contact with them on the VHF radio that ships use to be in contact. I radioed them a number of times and they did not respond. After about an hour and another try to radio them, they did respond and they spewed this kind of propaganda about we are headed towards a navally blockaded area and Israel will use all will do whatever is necessary to enforce what they called a lawful blockade in accordance with international law. And that's when I responded to them with some of the audio that you just played, because in that audio where they were responding to us over the VHF radio, they started talking about Hamas and why their blockade was lawful, which was all false. It was all absolutely not true. And therefore, I wanted them to know, which not that they would listen or anything, but that their blockade is by all international standards unlawful. And because it is deliberately, it's being used to deliberately starve a civilian population, it is also a war crime. What I kept repeating is that they need to refrain from attacking us. We are civilians. Do not use force against us and do not board our vessel. Do not obstruct our path to Gaza, where we are carrying food, medicine, and toys for children who you are starving. They, of course, did not listen to that. At some point, they jammed our GPS so we could no longer navigate. They cut our internet, and also the VHF, I couldn't call out on it anymore. I had put out a mayday just minutes before for all other vessels that we are under distress and coming under attack by the Israeli Navy, but then I couldn't use the VHF radio anymore. So we took our positions. We had practiced for this, for an Israeli boarding. We took our positions on the boat, and then they came for us. They deliberately came in the dark. They cut all communications before they board. They boarded dozens and dozens of soldiers. We lost count. They were masked. They were armed. They each carried number of different weapons on them, and they had cameras. And they were using their cameras to try to, you know, record what their propaganda is going to be, that they were gentle in the takeover, that they were humanitarian, that they tried to offer us food and water, which we refused, because not only is it propaganda, it disgusts us, actually. While at the same time that they are deliberately starving Palestinians, 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, and Palestinian children, that they want to pretend to be humane in giving us food and water. Our lives are not more important than the lives of the Palestinians in Gaza, that they are starving. And so we responded to them just that. We are not taking anything from an entity that is deliberately starving children in Gaza. They,
Who were the special forces, Huwaida? And how many ships did they come in?
Yep. To the best of our knowledge, it is Israeli Special Commando Force called Shayetet 13. It's one of their top, more elite commando forces, the same commando forces that had taken over the Freedom Flotilla vessels before, the same one that also attacked us in 2010, killing 10 of our activists.
That was the Mavi Marmara.
Yes. Yes, on the Mavi Marmara. And, you know, they are by no means, you could tell that their propaganda was in full display. They had almost as many cameras as they had soldiers on board. And
can you tell us who you were, the 21 of you? Explain where you're from, the journalists, the human rights lawyers, the human rights activists.
We represented about 12 actually different countries. A couple of us are citizens. We have Israeli passports, and that's myself and Bob Subedi, and this is why we were actually released. I can talk about that in a minute. But we had two parliamentarians, a member of the French Parliament and a member of the European Parliament. We definitely had journalists. We had medics. We had engineers. We had writers. We had poets. These are just average civilians from around the world. We don't have a military might or anything behind us. And we constantly say that, why is it that we had to be at sea in international waters in a small boat going to confront one of the most brutal militaries in the world? It is because our countries aren't doing it. Our countries are allowing Israel to deliberately starve Palestinians as part of this genocidal campaign that it has been carrying out. And we are horrified and not going to sit by and not do anything about it. So we are calling on others around the world, definitely our countries, to live up to their obligation of enforcing international law, of protecting human rights, but also other institutions that are founded to do the same. We should not be waiting for Israel to give permission for food or other humanitarian aid to enter. That we need to be challenging and breaking the blockade. So everyone that is just sending humanitarian aid through Egypt that we know is going to get in a long line at Rafah that Israel is not allowing to enter, they are just giving cover and participating again in Israel's deliberate starvation campaign. Maybe not purposefully, but we need to break the blockade. And our governments not only have not been doing anything about it, a few of the European governments, unfortunately, the U.S. government did not make contact with any of the seven American citizens on board, but the other, like France, Spain, Italy, contacted their citizens on board and told them that they are ready to provide consular services when Israel kidnaps us, which we found to be completely obnoxious. They were legitimizing Israeli piracy on the high seas. And that is unacceptable to us. And that is the kind of impunity that our governments, all governments really, have been allowing Israel to just violate international law. We had the right as internationals to sail peacefully in international waters without being pirated by the Israeli Navy. And yet all our governments could say is, we will provide consular services when you are kidnapped and taken against your will to Israel.
So
that's the message we got.
So now what has happened to the 21 people? Who has been released? So, who hasn't? Who has agreed to voluntary deportation? Have you?
We had the French parliamentarian who agreed to go almost immediately, and an Italian journalist and two of the Al Jazeera journalists. Those are the ones we know of. There are three people that the Adala lawyers are a legal organization in 48 that provides legal services, that has provided legal services to the flotilla before, but also does incredible work to protect the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel. They did not get a chance to see three of the participants. Myself and Bob Subedi were released. Israel, because we are citizens, they only had two choices, whether to release us or to charge us. They spewed some ridiculous charges against us that we tried to enter Israel illegally. And we said, you kidnapped us, you brought us here, we did no such thing. And then they said that we tried to enter a blockaded area. We said that we are sailing according to international law. And I think that they noted that their charges and their legal justification are ridiculous, because they did not charge us. They let us go without any conditions. But with the internationals, they are able to just deport them. The internationals refused to sign any kind of paper that said that they entered Israel illegally. And so they are brought before a court today. There's an administrative panel, unfortunately, which will just rubber stamp their deportation, no matter what argument we put forth, including the fact that Israel had no jurisdiction or no authority to kidnap us and bring us against our will to Israel.
And Hueda, you met with, we just have 20 seconds, a group of people who are on hunger strike after you got out?
Yes. Well, those of us who were on the boat went on immediate hunger strike when we were commandeered. And then I was brought, after I was released, to Yaffa, where the Arab leadership, it's called like the Arab Higher Committee, it's basically the Arab political leadership, are on an at least 3-day hunger strike, which started yesterday, demanding that food and medicine and aid being allowed into Gaza. So I joined them, and we just reaffirmed the importance of everybody taking all kinds of action and putting pressures on government to end Israel's policy of starvation and genocide.
Hueda Araf, Palestinian-American human rights attorney, speaking to us from Yaffa after she was detained and released after Israeli forces raided the Gaza Freedom Flotilla called Handala. Is there another one planned? Just 5 seconds.
We will not stop. Yes. So we are actively working on another one. We want the whole world to see the extent to which Israel goes to prevent baby formula from getting into Gaza, and hopefully rise up in all ways possible until the siege is broken, the genocide ends, and Palestine is free. We will continue sailing.
Thank you, Hueda Araf. Next up, in an attempt to quell the MAGA base uproar over the Trump administration's refusal to release the files of Jeffrey Epstein, Trump's deputy attorney general met for 2 days. He's also the former private lawyer for Trump with the convicted felon Ghislaine Maxwell, serving a 20-year sentence for conspiring with Epstein to sexually abuse young girls. Stay with us. We'll be joined by an investigative journalist who's been hosting a series called Chasing Ghislaine.
Said you're gonna shoot me down, put my body in the river. Shoot me down, put my body in the river. And the whole world sings. Sing it like a song. The whole world sings like there's nothing going wrong. He shot her down, he put her body in the river. He covered her up, but I went to get her and I said, my girl, what happened to you now? I said, my girl, we gotta stop it somehow.
Body Electric by Linda Segarra and Hooray for the Riff Raff performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In an attempt to quell the MAGA-based uproar over the Trump administration's refusal to release the files of the dead serial sex abuser Jeffrey Epstein, President Donald Trump's deputy attorney general, who is Trump's former private lawyer, just finished 2 days, Thursday and Friday, of meetings with the convicted felon Ghislaine Maxwell, who's serving a 20-year sentence for conspiring with Epstein to sexually abuse young girls. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche and Maxwell met for 9 hours at the federal courthouse in Tallahassee, Florida. This is Maxwell's attorney, David Marcus.
Ms. Maxwell answered every single question. She never stopped. She never invoked a privilege. She never declined to answer. She answered all the questions truthfully, honestly, and to the best of her ability.
The meetings with Ghislaine Maxwell at a federal courthouse in Tallahassee come as President Trump faces growing bipartisan pressure to release the government's files on Jeffrey Epstein, longtime friend of Donald Trump. On Friday, Trump was questioned if he considered pardoning Maxwell.
Would you consider a pardon or a commutation for Ghislaine Maxwell if she cooperated?
It's something I haven't thought about. It's really something.
It's recommended.
It's something I'm allowed to do, but it's something I have not thought about.
One of the first accusers of Jeffrey Epstein says she warned the FBI and the New York Police Department to look into his relationship with Donald Trump as early as 1996. Maria Farmer is now suing the government, which she said failed to protect victims. In a new interview with the New York Times, Maria Farmer said her only sense of justice has come from the conviction of Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's convicted sex trafficking accomplice. Maria Farmer also spoke on MSNBC with Jen Psaki about Ghislaine Maxwell.
I've never met a more predatory, terrifying human being in my entire life, and neither had Virginia Giuffre, and neither has Annie, or Anushka, or many girls like Shantae Davies. There's hundreds of us that were preyed upon by Ghislaine Maxwell. She's a very dangerous person, and she threatened my life on many occasions. I've had to move and be in hiding because of this predatory, child predator, and just victim predator. So it's completely unacceptable for anyone to call her a victim. The woman is not a victim. She's a victimizer.
So that's Maria Farmer, who has alleged that both Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein abused her and her sister, Annie Farmer, who has testified about how Ghislaine Maxwell not only groomed and recruited her, but also took part in her abuse. Annie Farmer spoke on ABC News.
She was the one who asked me to undress. She was the one who exposed my chest. She's the one who touched me. And I think that that was not unusual. I mean, that was something that came out in her trial and one of the things that she was found guilty of. If you know, the Department of Justice is clear on that she herself is a sexual predator who has participated in this abuse.
For more, we're joined by Vicki Ward, longtime investigative journalist, host and co-producer of the series Chasing Ghislaine, the untold story of the woman in Epstein's shadow. It's a podcast series. It's a TV series. Vicki Ward profiled Jeffrey Epstein for Vanity Fair in 2003. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Vicki. Let's go back to 2003. Before we talk about this deputy attorney general meeting, the fact that you tried to get Maria and Annie's story out so many years ago, you would have broken this story. But you talk about how the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair stopped you from doing this, and it came out to be just a kind of profile of Jeffrey Epstein.
That's right, Amy, and thank you for having me. Yeah, you know, I was assigned to write about Jeffrey Epstein, who was an enigma back then. He was not someone whose name was in the newspapers, except for the fact that he popped up in the fall of 2002 as having flown Bill Clinton on his plane to Africa. And on the back of that, I was assigned to go out and find who this kind of Gatsby-like figure was, who lived in the biggest private townhouse in New York, who had an island, a ranch in New Mexico. Where had his money come from? And along the way, I discovered that he had a reputation for having a lot of young women around him. This was in addition to Ghislaine Maxwell, who was sort of like a Girl Friday. It was her role became sort of very nebulous. And I did encounter the two farmer sisters who told me their harrowing stories. They went on the record, which was a very brave thing to do, given, as you heard, Maria Farmer just there saying that, you know, she felt they were coming after her for a lot of her life. And, you know, it was a difficult time for me. I was on a high-risk pregnancy. So once I'd handed the piece in, I went on bed rest before I ultimately went into labor. Jeffrey Epstein was threatening me and telling me he was going to find out where I was giving birth, and he was going to have a witch doctor place a curse on my unborn children if he didn't like this piece. He was clearly furious about the fact that I had spoken to the farmer sisters. That more than anything else about what I'd uncovered enraged him. And when I was at home on bed rest, I heard from a fact checker at the magazine who emailed me that he was in the Vanity Fair offices meeting with the editor-in-chief in person. I knew that the magazine was still waiting for photographs. Yes. And the next thing that I knew was, you know, when I saw a final galley of the piece that was already on its way to appear in the published version of the magazine, the farmer sisters' allegations had been removed. I will stress, I didn't obviously at the time have any idea of the scale of this awful sort of pyramid scheme that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell had going on with underage girls. But I did have the farmer sisters, and obviously it was appalling because they had gone on record. So Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were aware of what they had said, and it was a horrendous situation.
And so Jeffrey Epstein, there was this deal that ultimately would take down Alex Acosta once he became Secretary of Labor, because he was the U.S. attorney in Florida that cut this sweetheart deal that meant Jeffrey Epstein could serve 13 months in a Palm Beach jail, leaving every day for about 10 hours, in which the allegations are he abused one young woman after another. 13 months, then he was out, and it would take until 2019 for the federal charges to be brought in New York. Now, that's a lot to get in here, but these victims, let's talk about how many you believe there have been. I mean, you have one victim after another saying they were victimized, and then Ghislaine Maxwell or Jeffrey Epstein would say, can you go get others? One young woman said she can't live with herself. She recruited like 40 kids in her high school, girls, often, you know, poor, needing money. They would be paid something like $200. Another said 60. She recruited 60 friends. Are we talking upwards of 1,000 people? Children or young women who were abused or raped by Jeffrey Epstein with the help of Ghislaine Maxwell?
Well, Amy, I mean, that's actually a figure I think Pam Bondi, you know, I think she said 1,000. I mean, one of the things that became very, very clear when, you know, I sat through Ghislaine Maxwell's 6-week trial was the sort of the cleverness as well as the sickness of the manipulation that went on inside Jeffrey Epstein's household, beginning, if you like, with Ghislaine Maxwell, this very polished, sophisticated, Oxford-educated woman who spoke many languages, who knew presidents and heads of state all around the world. Once she had got these much more vulnerable young women inside that house, sort of effectively normalizing for them the incredible abuse that went on, you know, they were then incentivized to turn around and go and get, as you say, these other children. And it became, I mean, it, you know, one of the things that became very clear in her trial was the sickness, but also the scale of this web. And you know, one of the reasons that you sort of only had four victims come and testify at Ghislaine Maxwell's trial was that there were complications with other stories because you know, Virginia Roberts, for example, who was, you know, in a way, the single victim whose civil litigation against Ghislaine Maxwell ultimately caused this whole sort of house of cards to come tumbling down and Jeffrey Epstein finally to face the music in 2019. You know, Virginia Roberts' story is a complicated one because she then was accused of going out to recruit other girls. So it's a very complicated, horrible story.
Virginia Roberts, you're talking about Virginia Giuffre, who was an outspoken survivor and ultimately sued Prince Andrew and settled for some undisclosed amount and apparently died by suicide, though it's not clear she died by suicide. It's not clear Jeffrey Epstein died by suicide, but she just recently died in Australia at the age of 41.
Yes.
I want to get to President Trump, what his connection is to this, and who are the people who you feel have not been properly investigated? And this possibility, you heard Trump himself, you know, saying not clear whether she would be pardoned or her sentence commuted.
Right. And I also think, you know, it's worth thinking about the fact that Ghislaine Maxwell, you know, is a citizen of many countries. You know, another option is, you know, whether or not she would be sent back to Europe or to England, you know, where there may be a different view of her, given her background.
Given her background, meaning that she's the daughter of Robert Maxwell.
Well, she comes. Yeah, exactly. She comes from a family that's very prominent socially in England, that once held great power and great wealth, and you know, it's a different culture, different society. I mean, that I think would be an option.
He was sort of the competitor with Rupert Murdoch, a media mogul who she was very close to, and died mysteriously at sea, his body overboard.
That's right. But he was also a politician. He was a massive worldwide publisher who had enormous influence all around the world. As you say, he died in very strange circumstances. He's given a sort of hero's burial in Israel at the Mount of Olives. When he died, it emerged that he had basically robbed the pensions of his employees at this big media group. Two of his sons went on trial but were acquitted for that. But this is a story that is very, this is a family rather, that is very high profile in England and in Europe. You asked, Amy, though, about the relationship between Jeffrey Epstein and Donald Trump. You know, they were friends. They hung out with each other. These were two guys, you know, between Donald Trump's marriages, who were single and who both hung out with models. Jeffrey Epstein's main financial benefactor, Leslie Wexner, was the owner of Victoria's Secret, the most sort of prominent, you know, modeling organization in the world. We know, last week, the Wall Street Journal reported that when, for Jeffrey Epstein's 50th birthday, the Journal claimed, Trump denies this, it says it wasn't, you know, him, that, you know, Donald Trump sent him a sort of racy, congratulatory message alluding to Jeffrey Epstein's private life. So Donald Trump, you know, clearly we do know, was aware of Jeffrey Epstein's predilection for women and his sort of social life. They did fall out. Interestingly, Donald Trump, who is very articulate about a lot of subjects, has not ever really explained why. He has said to, campaign operatives around him, or did say back in 2014 when Virginia Roberts first sort of surfaced with her public claims about Epstein, that that he had severed ties with him when Epstein had come after a daughter of a member of Mar-a-Lago. There is also reportedly a dispute, there was a dispute between the two men over a piece of real estate near Palm Beach that both men wanted and that Donald Trump ultimately ended up getting at a bankruptcy auction and then flipped at a massive profit a couple of years later. But he's never actually talked about that in public. He has just said, he's just distanced himself.
We have 10 seconds, but we're going to continue with the post show with you because it's really critical to talk about what are these files the MAGA base and many Democrats and Republicans have called for releasing. Vicki Ward, longtime investigative journalist, host of the series Chasing Ghislaine.